Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
One thing that I'm going to say first is when it is about fighting corruption in this country, it is a very, very good fight to make.
A Guinean opposition leader demands inquiry into all public funds to ensure transparency and accountability.
You know, this is the first time in about 2 years that the National Executive Council Committee of the party has met. That is indicative. Since the president came to office, this is the first time the NEC is meeting. And that is also a meeting that goes to hold every quarter, at least four times a year. It's meeting for the first time in 2 years.
Nigeria's governing party, the APC, holds its first National Executive Committee meeting. We'll have an analysis.
When we returned from Burma during the war, 1945, they promised heaven, the British government here, promises so many things, accommodation, increase of salary, and so forth. They disappointed us.
And a World War II veteran shares an eyewitness account into the tragedy that led to the demand for independence in Ghana. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Guinea, the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc is calling for a thorough investigation into all public officials accused of corruption. Faye Milimino warns that double standards in the corruption fight will undermine any effort to combat financial wrongdoing. His remarks come after former Prime Minister Ibrahim Kasore Fofana was found guilty of corruption and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Fofana, who was Prime Minister under former President Alpha Conde, was convicted of embezzling $1.7 million from social welfare programs during the COVID-19 pandemic. The military ousted Conde in a 2021 coup and continues to govern the nation. Faye Milimino tells me that there must be an audit of the current government to ensure transparency and accountability.
We have a follow very closely with a lot of attention what is happening in the courtroom, especially concerning the former Prime Minister Kasore Fofana. One thing that I'm going to say first is when it is about fighting corruption in this country, it is a very, very good fight to make. Because if the country is being in that poor situation, it is because of the way all those people who belong to the government throughout the history have done when they were in the office. So we are following up with a lot of attention. What we have seen, though, is that it is like we're noticing a double standard.
Some people are saying it's double standard, that it appears that this is targeted at former President Alpha Conde and those who served in his cabinet.
That came to power and telling us that they're fighting corruption. They should themselves abide by the law. There are a lot of questions that we ask ourselves. We are not getting answers. How to become rich, the richest in this country in just 3 years? They have properties here in Guinea and everywhere. And all those appointed by the junta, we have here the cases of corruption concerning those people. No one is in jail. But they are going after those who were in the government 30 years ago, even the Lansana Conte's government. So we're seeing a double standard. What we're expecting from justice is that whoever in the position of power didn't manage public money very properly, all of them should face justice, and if they are recognized guilty, they should be sent to jail.
Fafaya, some people are saying that you are calling for those who embezzle public funds to be prosecuted and sent to jail if found guilty. But if they go after somebody who the court has found guilty, then you are complaining of double standards. So where do the people of Guinea go from here?
No. I mean, we are not complaining. We are not complaining about those people who are found guilty to be sent to jail. We are not complaining about it. What we are complaining about is if they're going after all the people who have stolen public money, they should do it for everybody, even for the current regime. But if they do, they don't do that for the current regime, and they're going after the former regimes, that is where we see a double standard.
So should there be a committee set up by the current military government for a thorough investigation into those who are alleged to have committed acts of embezzlement or acted corruptly in public office?
What we are asking ourselves today is to make a general audit of the junta governance. Because if we have to fight corruption in that country, we are not complaining about the court going after those with Lansana Conte, with Alpha Conde, who were in office and public money was stolen. We are not complaining about that. The fact that today, this junta has denounced when they came, it is happening today under the watch more than it happened during Lansana Conte and Alpha Conde time.
Faya Milimino is leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. In Nigeria, the governing party, the All Progressives Congress, or APC, has held its first National Executive Committee meeting since the last general election in 2023. President Bola Tinubu underscored his commitment towards the ruling party's stability with plans to resolve reports of crisis in state chapters of the APC. But notable absences at the National Executive Committee meeting in Abuja include former President Muhammadu Buhari, El-Rufai, a founding member of the APC, and Rotimi Amaechi, a former minister and campaign manager for Buhari's presidential campaigns. Some analysts say a report of a crisis within the APC appeared to be legitimate due to the alleged refusal of some top officials to participate in the meeting. For insight and political analysis, I reached Ibrahim Momo. He is a political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
When the president came to power, the national chairman, as it then was removed, and a new one was replaced. The deputy national chairman of the party, too, were removed and replaced. Some were given other roles to play, others, one of the ministers in this administration. It appears that the president has kind of hijacked the APC and is causing a lot of team fighting within the party. What we saw in today's net meeting was simply the president's men gathering and other stakeholders who perhaps do not agree with the thinking or are not in tandem with the position of the president, or the number of issues have been sidelined, and of course they didn't attend. A good number of them.
There was a notable absence during the next meeting. Former leader of the party and president of Nigeria, Muhammadu Buhari, was absent. El-Rufai, who is a former governor and a founding member of the party, was absent. Former minister Amaechi was also absent. And people are wondering what is really happening to the APC, the governing party.
In fact, this is the first time in about 2 years that the National Executive Council Committee of the party has met. That is indicative. Since the president came to office, this is the first time the NEC is meeting. It's indicated, and that is supposed to, a meeting that's supposed to hold every quarter, at least four times a year. It's meeting for the first time in 2 years. And then you see that one of the key persons, without doubt, that made it possible, campaigned vigorously, particularly in the northern part of the country, that saw to the election of this current president was Nasri El-Rufai, who was the former governor of Kaduna State, one of the volatile states in the north. He was, in fact, this president is on video, on record, it's on this video, on YouTube. He was in Kaduna when El-Rufai, Nasri El-Rufai was governor, and he was still on the podium, waited until El-Rufai came and made a public commitment to work with him. It would work if he eventually wins, if he wins the presidency. You know, so El-Rufai, and then he mentioned Rotimi Amaechi. Rotimi Amaechi was the director general of the APC Presidential Campaign Council on both occasions when President Muhammadu Buhari won elections. He was Minister of Transport, Super Minister. In fact, he came second in the presidential primaries of the APC. So that kind of person is also not. I'm not going to talk about. We have also mentioned the fact that the former, near past president Muhammadu Buhari, very popular in the north, was also not there. It shows that there's. It appears that the infighting within the APC, the ruling APC, is blowing up to the seams, and it also speaks to the fact that there's a failure of internal mediation or reconciliation mechanism within the ruling APC.
So where does the APC go from here, looking at the report of internal crisis of the party at the moment?
It's important to note that it is not the, it's not only the ruling APC that is embroiled in intra-party conflicts. The two main opposition parties, as it is today, even the three, party that came second, the PDP, is also in crisis. Recently, the presidential candidate of that party, Peter Obi, is on record to have said that he does not even know what is happening in the party, the Labour Party. And of course, the presidential election spokesperson, Kenneth Okonkwo, has resigned membership of the Labour Party. So you have this confusion. Then, of course, the party that came forth, and the New Nigeria People's Party, the NNPP, led by former governor Rabi Umusa Kwankwaso, he's said to have been suspended from the party where he's the POT chairman. You know, so a presidential candidate. So you see that there's confusion. So where does the APC go from here? It is serious just to note that the APC is not different from other political parties in terms of internal wrangling, in terms of crisis that has engulfed political parties. It shows that there's lack of internal democracy within political parties. So if political parties themselves, like the ruling party, the APC, is lacking in internal democracy, the question observers and concerned Nigerians are asking, if APC lacks internal democracy, how can it ensure, the ruling party, how can it now ensure the democratic ethos are maintained within the larger Nigerian society? That is the question people are asking.
Ibrahim Momo is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Born in Teshi, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, Warrant Officer Joseph Ashite Hammond fought in the Second World War. He was a mechanical engineer who served in the British Army under the West African Frontier Force 82nd Division. Upon his return to then Gold Coast after the war, he was among the soldiers who demanded payment from the British for their services following promises by the colonial power. Ashite Hammond was an eyewitness to the tragic shooting on February 8, 1948 that led to the deaths of leaders of the protest. The tragedy led to popular demands for independence. His legacy of service was internationally recognized when Ashite Hammond received the prestigious Point of Light Award from Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II for his humanitarian efforts. For more about his life, I reached Warrant Officer Joseph Ashite Hammond.
We were attached to the 3rd Infantry Battalion. We were mechanic, 10 of us. Myself, Hammond, Ibio Kain, and Kuranten, the three of us, were sent to 3rd Infantry Battalion. So we were attached to them, but what happened, we were mechanics co-infantrymen. Because when the enemy attacks, you have to defend yourself. We have to fight as an infantryman. But when there is no war, no fighting, we continue our repairing the American jeeps.
You were part of the protest and a witness of the 28th February 1948 shooting in Ghana, which led, as part of the effort to gain independence. Briefly, how was your experience?
You see, when we returned from Burma during the war, 1945, they promised heaven, the British government here, promised so many things, accommodation, increase of salary, and so forth. So we were patient. We waited patiently from 46, when we were discharged, 47, 48. We waited patiently to see if something could be done for us. They disappointed us completely. A lot of my colleagues even back in the streets. It was our situation was so deplorable. Our life was so deplorable. So we decided that if you don't act, they will not give you. So we decided to act. So we planned, we wrote a petition to the governor to consider our deplorable situation. On the way, the police, colonial police, intercepted the vigilance. We were highly trained and just from the war. We were not carrying arms. We were 210. And they asked where we were going. We said we were sending a petition to the governor, Gerard Creasy. Instead of listening to us, so we decided that, okay, we will select 10 men. It's policemen, you should give us guide to the castle. Just hand over the petition to the governor. Finish, then we come back. Still, he was adamant. He didn't want to do it. He wanted us to give him the letter. But our leader, Sergeant Jete, refused that the letter was addressed to the governor, not him. So we won't hand over the letter. Instead of actually accepting our advice, he gave the instructions, shoot three times. The man didn't do it. He was highly pissed. And he grabbed the gun himself. And then the first man that he shot was Private Odate Lampi at the front line. When he shot him, I was standing in the second line. I saw Pierre Sergeant Jete. I saw Atipu move.
So how do you feel as part of those who put pressure on the previous administration for Ghana to gain independence?
Actually, when this thing happened, there was pandemonium and confusion. So we all marched to the central business center, Accra. In front of the post office, there was a roundabout there. We all gathered there. 80% of us, 20% went to Osu Township, just few, but 80% to Accra. Any white man that we saw with a vehicle, we will stop him, we won't kill him, we will just grab him, throw him away, and then we turn the lorry, the car upside down, and then we put matches in the tank. We start burning all these things. Actually, I was among myself. I took part in the burning of the cars.
You have a foundation. Yeah. Your foundation has been fighting for the welfare of veterans and national development. Briefly tell me how your foundation is moving on so far.
You have asked a very sensible question. You see, when I returned from the war, I felt that my hands were full of blood. Because I fought in Butidon, Mayong, Pakoku, Mabu, and Kindongi. Ferocious fighting. And God saved me. I didn't die, and I came back home. Now, I feel that I must do something. So I established this foundation, Hammond Foundation, for peace now, not for war. So we have been giving, like philanthropists, we have been giving help to other people. We also, whoever approaches, and we try to do everything to help them. Those downtrodden, to give them help. We are now, we have projects. We are building hospitals, helping fishermen, and so many things, and education also.
Warrant Officer Joseph Ashite Hammond is Ghanaian who fought in the Second World War. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations has bid farewell to the representatives from Caribbean member states. This after describing them as, quote, a powerhouse within the Commonwealth. Madam Patricia Scotland, who has led the group for 9 years, is scheduled to officially step down in March. Her remarks came during the recent 48th meeting of the Conference of Heads of Government of the Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, in Barbados. When she came to office in 2016, Scotland promised to advocate for small island development status SIDS and put it at the heart of the Commonwealth's mission. I reached out to Madam Scotland via Microsoft Teams to talk about her achievement, her relationship with the CARICOM, and what she's been able to do for the region. She also spoke about climate change and how it affects the Caribbean, as well as what she plans to do next. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
You know, I sometimes think we in the Secretariat, we're like a little bird that goes, a magpie, picking up all the little jewels from across the Commonwealth and bringing them back and sharing them with everyone, so that everything I've spoken about, everything, has been created and inspired by our countries and with our countries. We have been so helped by the experts in every field. And the beauty of the Commonwealth is you have the five regions. So you have small ones, big ones, squeeze middle, rich ones, poor ones. You've got every religion, every race, every complexion. So when we come together, the power of what we can do is exponentially greater than any of us could do on our own. So I think what I've seen is friendship and family in action, because, you know, we've always said that the Commonwealth of Nations is a family. And what I have seen in the last 9 years is that family really kick it out of the park. They've been there with each other in every time of trouble. What I've noticed in this region, you know, some people, when you're in trouble, they run away from you.
Right, right.
In the region, they run towards you.
Aha.
And that's a big difference. And you saw that in each of the hurricanes. Everybody was gathering money, sending blankets, anything they could. And that's family. That's family.
So, Madam Secretary General, after 9 years, when you decide or when the time is up for you to hand over, what do you plan on doing next?
Well, we just have to wait and see, because you know me, I am doing this job until the last day, wanting to make sure that all the great things we've done get handed over, because my sister from Ghana was elected in Samoa at the last right. Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting to be the next Secretary General. And so I want to make sure everything is in apple pie order, because I'm sure she's going to fly and she'll do a great job.
Well, I was going to ask you about your reflections as the first female Secretary General handing over to another female first from Africa in, you know, Madam Ayoko Buchi. Talk to me about your reflections on that.
Well, I think it's a real sign of where we are. You know, I always said from the beginning, if you remember, that I was the first Secretary General for the Commonwealth, but I really hoped that I wouldn't be the last. And I hoped that we would be able to seamlessly go from one good Secretary General, which I hope I've tried to be, to another good Secretary General, almost without reference to whether that person is male or female. But you must know there is a certain degree of satisfaction when you see that those who were asked to choose, and it's the heads who elect, they decided to choose another woman. Mm. So I think times are changing.
So before you go, your final words to those who will be listening to you or watching you from the Commonwealth and beyond.
What I would say to them is thank you. Thank you for allowing me to serve you. It has been the privilege of my life to do so. Thank you for standing with me. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. Thank you for sharing your commitment. And may God bless you always, because I will ask God to bless you, because without you, we couldn't have done anything. So it's really thank you, and thank you.
Madam Patricia Scotland is Commonwealth Secretary General. She spoke with me from Bridgetown, Barbados. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, President Felix Tshisekedi has rejected calls for direct dialogue with the M23 rebels. Local media note a government statement in which the president listed the country's sovereignty, security threats, and foreign interference as the core reasons behind his decision not to directly talk with the rebels. The government has designated the M23 a terrorist organization that lacks legitimacy and represents foreign interests. It also blamed the group for displacing tens of thousands of civilians from their homes as it seized territory in the eastern part of the country with little resistance from the DRC National Army. The statement comes after a joint East Africa Community and the Southern African Development Community meeting that called for ceasefire and dialogue to resolve the conflict in the DRC. The EAC and SADC named three former leaders of African nations, Nigeria's Olusegun Obasanjo, Ethiopia's Haile Mariam Desalegn, and Uhuru Kenyatta from Kenya to mediate in the crisis. For analysis, I reach Antoine Lokongo. He is a lecturer at the University of Kinshasa.
I find it as a contradiction because the president himself, when he was in Germany, for the first time, he said that he was facing an armed opposition. He called the M23 the armed opposition. And of course, the M23 is not the only armed group in Eastern Congo. There are more than 200 of them. So I think that when you recognize that you face an armed opposition, the next thing is either you try your best to quell the rebellion, or there's no other alternative but to talk to them. I think anybody will draw such a conclusion.
He cited instances of national sovereignty, the DRC's national sovereignty, and that what the M23 rebels are doing is undermining the country's territorial integrity. That is one of the reasons he cited for rejecting calls for the dialogue. What do you make of this?
If the AFC, Alliance Fleuve Congo, Nanga's AFC, and the M23 are recognized by President Felix Tshisekedi himself as an armed group, and they occupied chunks of land in Eastern Congo, we don't even have access to those parts which they control. So we have lost sovereignty in those parts, because the mining, agricultural land, the population, the government has no authority over these chunks of land anymore. So our sovereignty is very much now at stake. And like I said to you last time, we welcome this round of talk. President Obasanjo knows the situation very well since the CNDP, President Uhuru, and the former president of Ethiopia, because Ethiopia houses the African Union, so he knows the situation very well. Any solution that will avert balkanization of Congo is very much welcome. for as of now, our sovereignty is at stake.
But do you think the efforts so far, including the choice of these three former African leaders to help resolve the ongoing conflict, will make any significant impact in the ongoing conflict in the eastern part of the DRC?
There is a joke going around here that the three are all English-speaking country, and that Cecil Rhodes' scheme from Cape to Cairo, people are afraid that Eastern Congo may be slashed off and become a part of this old from Cape to Cairo scheme, very dear to the Anglo-Saxon. But that's just a joke, because they say that why are they not former African French-speaking countries also involved? But of course, there are many, many, many people. The joke goes that these people, they want to die in power. There's no former French-speaking, former African president around. But you have Gbagbo in Ivory Coast. You have Shishano in Mozambique, although he's a Portuguese speaking. You have Wade, and so on and so on. But like I said to you, President Obasanjo understands the situation very well, and Uhuru Kenyatta, of course. And if they mutualize the EAC and the SADC effort, and if that lead to saving Congo from balkanization, that will be a very good thing. That's what we expect of them. But still, the big contradiction still comes from Kinshasa, because Kinshasa mutualized its forces with Uganda. And Uganda now, if you ask Ugandan troops to leave today, they say they will not leave. Because like Kagame, they say they are still threats from Congo. Uganda could still face threats from Congo. And Kagame says Rwanda could still face threats from Congo. So the situation is becoming like a stalemate.
Antoine Lukongo is a lecturer at the University of Kinshasa. He spoke with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from African collection. But first, in Uganda, the Electoral Commission is warning political parties and aspiring candidates that they will be violating the law if they start campaigning before the scheduled time. This after Julius Muchunguzi, the spokesperson for the electoral body, says political parties must stick to the Electoral Commission's roadmap in the run-up to the general election. Opposition and civil society groups have expressed concern about what they say appears to be a lack of transparency, insufficient stakeholder engagement, and compressed timelines that could undermine the integrity of the polls. For more insight into the Electoral Commission's warning, I reach its spokesperson, Julius Muchunguzi.
The Electoral Commission of Uganda, which manages the electoral process in the country, issued a roadmap that guides all actors in the electoral process to follow in the lead-up to the 2025 and 2026 general election. And on that roadmap, there are milestones, including one that the Commission has just concluded, which has been the update of the National Voters Register. After that, there will be a phase for nominations. Now, according to the Electoral Commission and electoral processes in Uganda, you can only begin to campaign after the Commission has nominated you as an official candidate for any elective position in the country. And before any nominations have taken place, you are not allowed to campaign. And therefore, the context of advising all political actors and all political parties to follow the guidelines that are issued by the Electoral Commission in respect of when campaigns can begin is anchored in that particular provision, that you can only campaign officially once the Electoral Commission has nominated you as a candidate for an elective position.
Julio, some are speculating that perhaps this year and next year's general election will be competitive, and that is why the aspiring candidates and political parties appear to be in a haste to campaign.
If there is competition in the electoral process, that is what should be, because credible and free and transparent elections should be competitive, so that many parties, many candidates come out and show interest in service, in leadership of the country. And so that is not necessarily a problem. What is at issue is when political parties or candidates come out to begin a campaign process and put everybody in a mood of campaigns before the flag off of that campaigning period by the Electoral Commission. Because the people of Uganda have many things to be doing. They have their businesses to run. They have their livelihoods to earn. Investors have their businesses to ensure they continue to be productive. And so it doesn't really go down well to begin to engage in campaigning when the right time, as provided for by law and also provided for by the Electoral Commission, has not come.
Some are also suggesting that the political parties have devised a way of saying they are engaging with their supporters or rallying support with a national tour, which they said is a camouflage. Is this how the Electoral Commission sees it?
The law provides, especially for presidential candidates, a provision for consultations. But consultations are also defined in the guidelines and in what manner, in what form. Consultations are not expected to be rallies, public rallies. When you are doing consultations, the guidelines to that effect are that, you are either in small groups, one-on-one, in enclosed presses, and so political parties. Is by the Political Parties and Organization Act, which is the law that governs the conduct of political parties, to do those kind of outreaches and mobilizations. But when it comes specifically to campaigns, those ones are clearly defined in the law and in the guidelines. And that is why the Commission insists that campaigns can only take place or should only take place during the declared and gazetted periods. And when you don't do that, when political parties begin to campaign before that period, basically they undermine the guidelines that are provided and can easily cause confusion.
Julius Muchunguzi is Uganda's Electoral Commission spokesperson. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Also in Uganda, the executive director of the Human Rights Network for Journalists says the group may seek legal redress if the government implements plans to have media professionals undergo compulsory cadre training. Robert Sempala says the government should instead create incentives and the infrastructure to improve the professionalism of the news media. His comments came after Balaam Barugahara Ateni, the state minister for youth and children's affairs, confirmed reports that the government has directed journalists to undergo a mandatory cadre course at the National Leadership Institute in Chankwanzi. The institute is an organization that trains the country's leaders in public service. Robert Sempala tells me that the requirement will undermine media freedom in Uganda.
That is very strange. It comes at a time when we least expected it, and most importantly, coming from people that are supposed to nurture the media, to put an environment that is conducive for the media to flourish professionally, is so upset that all you see is pushed in the media in a corner of militarization. There's been efforts and traces that have pointed to militarization of the country, where you have military managing different public order spaces in agriculture, in construction, in the health sector, in in so many public spaces, but we didn't see it come to the media to this extent. And I'm sure if anything that the government has with the media, it should be capacitating them to professionalize.
What do you say to supporters of the NRM, the ruling party, who are saying that Ugandan journalists have consistently demonstrated the lack of patriotism required to move the country forward, and that they are hiding behind freedom of expression to undermine the very sovereignty and territorial integrity of the country, and such, you know, instilling of patriotism in them could do a world of good for the Ugandan society?
I think those are disparate measures by the very people that have not done enough to professionalize the industry, that have not put in place incentives for the media industry to grow, and are resorting to suffocation of the same media. Because supposing the media is to act like cadres, how else are they going to bring out the very key tenets of democracy, where you're supposed to be fair, to be objective, and be a watchdog, and you're above self, because the media is a public good? How is that going to happen? So those that have that school of thought are really pressing the wrong buttons. And in any case, we have seen it not work, because there was a time in Uganda when all students that are going to go to public universities would be taken to the same school for cadre training. But let alone when they would come back, they would even vote their student leaders, the guild presidents and their councils from the opposition political parties, those that are embedded to the political opposition. So it stopped because it wasn't bearing fruit. In any case, people are not taking good lessons. What the media needs today is an environment that will facilitate them to do their work professionally, that will make them feel secure, that sense of security, and that will not suffocate them in terms of taxes. They need subsidies from government, and they also need to have a fair regulation in terms of the laws and the regulators. You won't need to take the journalists and the media owners for cadre trainings if the environment is set up under such a firm ground.
So, Robert, what has been the reaction among journalists and media owners in Uganda following this announcement by Minister Balam?
Yeah, many have received the news as a surprise. Some have just jokingly laughed it off. And the way Mr. Balam brought it out is to the effect that it's not out for negotiation. It is a must. And you can only force a donkey to the well. You can't force it to drink the water. So he's very confident about the move, but I can foresee a situation where it doesn't bear any fruit, even when the said journalists will be forced to go for cadreships. It won't bear fruits. I have seen journalists that are standing for political offices here in Uganda. And interestingly, even those that have worked for government turn out to stand on the opposition political tickets. It means that you only can employ them, give them a salary for something, but when they choose to make their decision, they can do it either side.
Robert Sempala is Executive Director of the Human Rights Network for Journalists. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Southern African energy experts and political leaders pledged to improve access to energy at a massive summit in Botswana this week. The commitment comes as most countries in the region are still reliant on coal, a major contributor to global warming. For viewing, Kodisi Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Gaborone.
More than 500 participants from 16 Southern African Development Community or SADC member states, as well as other African countries, participated in this week's Energy Summit. Moses Ntlamele, a senior programs officer at SADC, says that pursuing a more inclusive transition to cleaner energy was one of the resolutions regional representatives adopted at the summit.
The region is recommended to expedite the just energy transition and explore the development of the regional renewable energy market. This is to ensure nobody's left behind, in as much as we are going for cleaner energy, but ensure that this energy transition is just to everybody. And of course, even those who are at a lower income level, they have to be considered.
In his remarks at the summit, Botswana President Duma Boko spoke about the need to end energy poverty.
Countries across the SADC region face challenges related to energy poverty. These constrains our economies, leaving millions of our people, especially in the rural areas, without access to critical services like health, education, communication, and such like. A clarion call for an energy secure region is, therefore, urgent in order to drive industrialization and integration of our economies.
Most Southern African countries still rely on coal-fired power for energy. President Boko called on the region to cut its dependence on fossil fuels and speed up the transition to green energy.
We should incentivize renewable energy and energy efficiency projects and initiatives, enforce environmental protections, and establish clear roadmaps for a just and equitable energy transition, which is relevant to the realities of our countries and our region. As a region, let us set tangible targets, not only to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, but also to increase our use of renewables.
Yunus Alkore is a technical expert at the intergovernmental organization, the East Africa Center for Renewable Energy and Efficiency. He tells VOA that if Africa wants to accelerate its transition to sustainable energy, several key measures are needed.
There has to be policies in place and regulatory framework. And what this does is it creates a transparent, long-term and consistent targets. And this is something which investors need. This is something which development partners need.
Alokore says that in addition to policies and regulations, access to finance is also key and that funding should match specific needs. Kondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa and this is the time to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
The alphabet, so I could put you next to letter I. Take my heart, baby, carry go. If you leave me, baby, I go die. Neptune as soon as it's a kete kete. Or camera footage, I know you're risi risi. Nisi mojira smile, si risi ri. Open it once, I'm in it, no chili chili. Hey, me baby, me bro, ni yo. Golden tree chocolate, yeah. Me chato, ni yo. Each and every day. My own, that time of the chest, I'm then no money day. My own, see my heart, but push it up at the grind for my kenge. My own, like the air and the feeling for everywhere I day. My own, see the money, baby, come chop on for me. And I've been saying, Ghana, what's up in here? What's up in here? Chat to me, yeah. Chat to me, girl, yeah. With time, make a carry you. Champagne and I was the Malibu. Yeah. And then dinner, eat it just for two. Me dog, now we do me see, baby, yeah. My own. That time of the chase, I'm then no money day. My own. See my heart, but push it up at the grind for my king. It's
Le temps comme un fleuve, il ne retourne jamais à sa source. Hey, hey. Et moi je suis comme le temps. Bébé nanana na kraka yo na kozonga jamais. C'est toi mon amour pour toujours. Bébé 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 bébé.
Vitamine à l'envers nanga yo zawapi. Bébé mon amour tu me manques trop. Bolingwe koni lokola moi noya béni. Mon bébé, mon bébé.
Sa job na so sufrir la la mona yo anga shinga ta wisie esenga motoli bo sona buki mi be kwa bolingo mon bébé bébé bébé
sinon ni m'amouré les alors
bébé on la wisinga koleka pakaleo
o sam volinga sans ma babou bébé mon amour mon bébé
professeur docteur René Kanzana Canada.
Sala kiban be si shiru kininga na ebale nana ko senga nzambe fave tokutana na kwaru couple na biso e de kore sa loyal disto ape sa biso troya maria jete ba yanga ya libela to fly mon bébé
Marius Bayende. Paul Nebo, Gingoya,
d'amour, c'est toi,
l'air qui laisse.
C'est pour toi, c'est pour toi, mort.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Douglas Impuga, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a mouse that tries to bite the scrotum of a sleeping cat must be fed up with life. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.